Chapter 17, The Search for Coherence. "I'm sorry," said the exasperated, desperate, completely out of ideas foster adoptive mom of 7-year-old Nathan as he moved into the second half hour of yet another seemingly meaningless, seemingly out of the blue meltdown. Both career military folks, these parents had not just fallen off the apple cart. They had cared for other angry, troubled kids and had even adopted one. But Nathan, who had just kicked his great big dad in the face and was screaming and punching wildly at the moment, was different. He had never listened to reason, which made no sense to the highly developed left brains of these reasonable parents. He never seemed to care about the consequences they warned of and sometimes implemented. He didn't seem to learn from his mistakes. Everything was always the fault of someone else. He didn't seem to catch on to cause and effect, and he was utterly unpredictable. In fact, there seemed to be no core him, at least not one they could find and maybe get to know. The practices of many infant mental health clinicians became quite full after about 1985, as the influx of children from Romanian orphanages hit our shores and everyone started taking more careful notice of what some foster adopt parents were trying to tell us. With children who perplexed both us and the parents who tried to care for them. These particular children seemed almost allergic to attachment. Their numbers were small. Indeed, many foster adopt parents, upon meeting their first one, exclaimed that they had never seen a child like this. After years of looking after abused, neglected, and throwaway children. But the impact of these children was huge. They fought for control in the families who struggled to look after them, and they usually won. Operant conditioning strategies were laughably ineffective, but so were individual talk therapies. The children were often attracted to blood, fire, and gore, and were promiscuous in their connections to grown-ups, embarrassing the foster or adoptive mother, for example, by asking a stranger at the mall to take them home, please, because their mother hated them or refused to feed them. Behavior at school or church was often, although not always, markedly better than at home, leaving community members confused about what in the world the foster or adoptive parents were complaining about. So targeted was the rage of some of these children toward the figure of the mother, the representation of the one who left me, that even foster or adoptive fathers sometimes doubted or accused their wives, creating self-denigrating and crippling isolation for many of the mothers. Nathan was 1.5 when first adopted by these determined, persistent, organized, and well-informed parents. He was born with bilateral cleft lip and palate, requiring multiple surgeries. He had suffered many losses in those first 18 months before finding this family, and he had worked for years to take this family apart. Nothing seemed to work with him, and his parents were at their wits' end. Mom really couldn't explain why, on this unexpected night, a brand new set of words came pouring out of her mouth. Her speech on this night, she thought, sounded crazy, desperate. It came from a part of her brain from which she seldom spoke. "I'm sorry your life started out not how you wanted. I'm sorry your mom left you with that city official. I'm sorry you were scared and confused. I'm sorry that you had to go to that children's home just when you were starting to calm down. I'm sorry you then had to go to where Ms. Cynthia was. I'm sorry that you were mad, afraid, confused, and very sad, and then you had to have that surgery. You must have been awfully frightened about moving from one place to the next, not knowing what was going on. I'm sorry we weren't there to stop all of that from happening. If we had been there, we would have done our best to protect you and make you feel safe and not afraid. I'm sorry your life didn't start out the way you needed it to. But we're here now, and we'll do our very best to make sure you're safe, that you don't feel afraid, that you have food and clothes when you need them and a hug when you need it. Mom said she couldn't stop herself from rambling. The words were coming from an unfamiliar place in her. Dad, still lying on the floor near to Nathan, was stunned but didn't interrupt. It almost went unnoticed that Nathan wasn't fighting anymore. He was quietly staring at his mom. Her voice was a little quieter now, and she was speaking more slowly. I'm sorry your heart feels so angry right now, but really that's your heart feeling sad, and your body just doesn't know what to do. You're trying to make us feel the way your heart feels right now. I'm sorry we can't change how your life began, but we're here now. We can control and work on now. We can't fix or change what happened in China because your body doesn't know what to do with all these feelings. It's lashing out in anger at the very people who are here for you, who love you, and who want to help you feel loved. Mom said she didn't know why she finally shut up at this point. Maybe she noticed that Nathan was actually listening, an extremely rare thing for him. He lay there beside his dad on the floor for a little while, then quietly walked to his room, made up his bed, which he had torn up earlier, and went to sleep. Mom and Dad had no idea what to do next, so they did nothing. They just sat there in the living room. Pretty soon they went to bed too. Everybody was drained. The next morning, a calm Nathan walked out, all dressed, ate something, and went to school. He had a great day, he said. That night, a Tuesday, he was kind to his sister. It didn't last, of course. He wasn't all better. This would not be his last meltdown, nor would he stop lying or lashing out or peeing on his dirty clothes or forgetting how to do a math problem he had just succeeded in doing 2 minutes before. But something had changed. A hurt child was seen. A set of desperate, persistent parents gave up on trying to get control and focused only on trying to get connected. Of course, connection itself was terrifying to Nathan and likely would continue to unsettle him, but it was also the thing he wanted most in the world, and his parents chose to just go for that and forget the rest for the moment. They saw their little boy, and it changed both him and them. He learned a little about his body, his heart, his anger, and the connections between all of those things. These parents attuned to a Nathan that wasn't much in evidence at the moment, but a Nathan they began to imagine they really did know. They wondered about his life and presented him with the astonishing, life-changing results, parts of a coherent narrative. They held him by letting him know that he had made sense to them, that they got it. Curiously, even though there was not one thing in Mom's monologue that she didn't already know about at some level, empathy increased in both parents. 6 years into the adoption, something became clearer to them during this peculiar exchange about who this little boy was. We're often astonished to discover just how much chaos and incoherence inhabits the mind of certain children of loss and trauma. Absent facts, absent clear memories, absent a coherent narrative, they can't figure out who to be, how to be, with whom to be. An everyday interaction can evoke vague and frightening ideas against which the child flails. but he's shoveling smoke. He doesn't make progress, not without a story about his life that makes some sense. Nathan's parents stumbled into the sweet spot. They were what he needed that night. The sudden change in his affect, and for a few days at least, his behavior, told them that they were on to something. I was a minor player. They were the ones who had learned to become storytellers for their little boy, helping his life to make sense to him. Parents, of course, also struggle to integrate their narratives, the ideas about themselves and how things work that we all create internally with the present situation. Coherence in the narrative often escapes them, leaving them floundering to articulate, much less make sense of, their own experiences. They sometimes clutch at rigid ideas about child development and rigid parenting beliefs. It's one of the several reasons why psychoeducation often falls flat. We can't change narratives with argument or instruction. Narratives tend to stick. They're not necessarily logical, so they're not easily subject to alteration through discussion. They represent an effort to make sense of things, so both children and grown-ups tend to treasure them and cling to them even when they've never actually been articulated. For example, more than once I heard the bad milk narrative from a mom, often evoked when I ask about breastfeeding decisions. "Oh no, I didn't have a choice about that. The doctor said there was something in my breast that I could pass on to my baby if I nursed him. My ma had the same thing. I guess I caught it from her. I think she caught it from my grandma." When asked about what this thing was that might be passed on, I was often flummoxed to learn that the mom had never gone further in her thinking or questioning about the imaginary danger. She actually had no idea what the it was. The doctor, of course, had never said any such thing. But the story had power. My sense was that it was a metaphor for some unconscious awareness of a problem in the family, one that was infectious or could be passed on from one generation to the next. Coincidentally, my early practice in infant mental health was in northern rural Michigan, in the very heart of the farming area most profoundly affected by the PBB crisis of that era. Polybrominated biphenyls were introduced into the food chain in 1973 when a flame retardant was accidentally mixed into cattle feed. The problem was not discovered until the tainted bags of feed had been widely distributed and cattle started dying. PBBs quickly entered the food chain through milk and other dairy products, beef products, and contaminated swine, sheep, chickens, and eggs. Breastfeeding mothers were concerned, of course, and some stopped nursing. The epicenter was a little village called Falmouth, Michigan, and it was precisely where I lived. It was not a faraway phenomenon for families in Falmouth. It was right in our faces. It wasn't uncommon for me to encounter huge piles of cattle carcasses alongside the barn when I made home visits. But not one of the moms with the bad milk narrative linked their worry to the PBB crisis. The narrative continued to show up in my practice for many years and at great geographic distance from the epicenter of the crisis. Never did the narrative suggest that the mom by herself had been tainted, for example, by PBB. It was always that the bad milk had been passed to her by her own mother. One mother said, "My milk ain't no good in my breast. That's why I didn't nurse none of my kids. Oh, and my ma's got the same thing. She gave it to me." That a particular narrative was full of transference or seemed patently false or silly mattered not one whit to the person clinging to it in the unconscious hope that it would make sense of lives or events that seemed random or threatening. Coherence was often elusive. The absence of coherence only made assertion of the narratives more aggressive, defensive, and rigid. A dad, terrified of his own impotence when trying to come to grips with the birth of a tiny, premature son, for example, might declare, "That damn kid wears me out, carrying him all over the place. He weighs a ton." Trying desperately to make sense of his son's early birth, the prospect of developmental delays, the sight of his boy in that awful isolette, and his own helplessness to undo any of it, his unconscious came up with a solution. Simply deny it all and assert how heavy his boy was, even as he could feel right there in his own arms that it wasn't true. Sometimes a parent narrative became a direct threat to the development of the child, or even her survival. I watched with astonishment the behavior of a mom during an assessment of her 4-year-old daughter. Something was driving her to aggressively contain this little girl on her lap while I pursued, rather pathetically, I suppose, my goal of administering a developmental test. Bonnie seemed to fight furiously for space, if not for escape, from her mother's grasp. But my observation of the fight for escape was confused by the fact that, when presented with brief opportunities to actually get away, Bonnie usually took a pass. What appeared to be a fight began to look more like a dance of some kind. Why couldn't Mom let her go? As I approached the trailer for the very first session, I overheard Bonnie's mom saying to her daughter, through sobs, "Oh, Bonnie, you're all I've got. If I didn't have you, I wouldn't have nothing. I wouldn't have nothing." We hadn't even met, and already I was being introduced to what would prove to be the dominant theme in the family: Mom's panic over child loss. As so often happens in infant mental health, I was being given scraps of a narrative long before I knew the underlying story. I was unprepared for the manifestations of Mom's panic in the form of her assertion of unrelenting control over Bonnie inside that trailer. She pushed, pulled, ran her hands through Bonnie's hair, intruded upon tasks I tried to present to Bonnie. At one point, evidently in response to Bonnie's wriggling, Mom delivered several hard swats to Bonnie's buttocks, then lectured her, "How's that act on your bottom? Now you just sit there and think about what you've done." Of all ironies, Mom then taught me, she don't like to be closed in. Frustrated and confused, I asked if Bonnie could sit alone in the chair near me at the table while Mom sat just behind her. This separation lasted only seconds, however. As if enraged at Bonnie for being near to me and not to her, she now jerked her arm, pulled her in close, and delivered several more swats. They were harder this time. Then, to my astonishment, Mom pulled off both of Bonnie's shoes, whereupon Mom sat back in her chair, smiling at me, looking over the sobbing heap of her daughter. Only later, back at my office, where I was poring over the video I had made of the session, along with the results of this strange administration of developmental tests, did any of it start to make sense. Reviewing Mom's responses to the developmental milestone questions, I noticed a strange inconsistency. Whereas the referring agency noted severe delays in nearly all areas of Bonnie's development, including the fact that she was still not walking when she entered a special education program at age 2, Mom asserted that Bonnie walked quite early. Indeed, she remembered the exact day. She said she had looked out the window of the trailer one day, only to see Bonnie walking down the road, dragging a lawn chair behind her. She was 8 months old. Once again, I was faced with doubting the truth of the assertion while somehow believing the mother. The coincidence did occur to me, of course, as I had encountered it many times relative to the deep meaning walking has for some parents. Some babies begin to crawl at 8 months or so, and some parents with deep fears of loss interpret this simple developmental gain as abandonment. Why would Bonnie's mom do that? And what should I do with the further coincidence that the test results for this 4-year-old child suggested that while she was delayed by only 2 years in her motor development, her developmental age on the mental scales showed a delay of 3.5 years? Bonnie was developmentally 8 months old. She had stopped growing at just the age Mom remembered that her little girl left her, or tried to leave her. Was it then that Mom started holding her daughter so tightly she could barely move? Our final home session a few days later was given over to talking about the test results. Mom listened to all of it, most of it pretty bad news, without protest or denial, to my surprise. She waited until I was packing everything up to leave that final session to let me in on the rest of the story. She introduced it by asking, in a stunningly innocent way that made it seem off the cuff, a question. What did I know about the rights of adoptees? I set down my briefcase, leaned on the door jamb, suppressed my impulse to give her practical guidance about the rights of adoptees, and asked why she was asking. Oh, I don't know. I was just thinking about my other kids, the ones I lost. I sputtered something about her having told me that Bonnie was her first child, then just shut up, while she taught me the story upon which her incoherent narrative was built. Bonnie was actually her fourth child. The first one died soon after birth. The next two were removed from her by Child Protective Services in another state at their ages 6 and 7. She wasn't supposed to get pregnant again. Indeed, she had had a tubal ligation after the removal of her children. The fact that Mom got pregnant after a tubal made Bonnie very special. Bonnie was going to be the one who wouldn't leave. Mama wouldn't let her. It has always been our special responsibility in infant mental health to hear the story behind the present circumstances, to hear the cries of babies and parents beneath their present behavior, to listen for the narratives irrespective of their coherence, and to keep looking for that which just might make it all come together. It calls for such restraint, such modesty, such patience. We grow weary sometimes. We want to just get on with it. We want people to sit up straight and talk sense. But then again, that's when we know we're running into our own narratives, not all of which are resolved, much less coherent. So we go back to work on ourselves, searching for the capacity to listen some more. And we wait for the heart of the story once again.